Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City. And today, it's been a little while, and we thought we'd come back and maybe revisit something we covered early on in the podcast a couple of years ago, which is displays. And they're constantly changing, constantly evolving technology. It's been a couple of years since we touched on it. A lot of things have happened. And we thought maybe it'd be worthwhile to sort of revisit that as a topic of conversation and see how things have changed, see what's stayed the same, and if we've changed our opinions on the things we said a couple of years ago. Do you guys, since we last did the podcast, I think the biggest change is that the fact that the plasma is now just dead. It's done. It's finished. There's really no plasma, models available. That's kind of a big change. I think does that change the way you guys think about displays at all, or how you guys are thinking about the display market?
We invested in a BT300 very late on. And so we're still running it, and we're still using it as just a client reference monitor. So I think it's a good thing to have around just to check in on. But those things are going to last forever too. If you've bought one, what are they rated for? Millions of hours or something?
I think it's something like 100,000 hours. I could be wrong. I don't think.
It's not in the millions, but yeah, it's a lot. It's gonna. I mean, you could run it for a very long time without having any issues. So, but the thing about the plasmas, I'm sure we touched on it last time, can they be calibrated close to the other monitors, really?
ABL is still an issue with the plasmas. I think there are lovely displays. I think I still have my plasma at home that I use, and we still have a BT300 as well at the color space that we use in the suite upstairs. So obviously they're still going to be around for a while, and they're kind of floating around, and people are still using them. I think, you still, up until fairly recently, I think you still saw a fair number of color shops that were using CRTs. So that lasted a while, and I don't know if plasmas will have that kind of longevity for their post-death life, but I think their use will continue for a little bit. I still feel pretty confident saying that you can use a BT300 or something similar as like a very nice client reference display. I think it still works quite well for that purpose.
One of the big themes that I've seen too is the idea that it's changing month by month, especially as new displays get released and LCD matures and OLED matures. Mm-hmm. It, let's say, becomes more affordable based on size and availability. But the thing that's the tough moment that I see a lot of companies dealing with for the last few months, this might be coming to an end soon, is just there was no obvious monitor to get in place of an aging plasma. So, you had the VT60 and maybe the ZT60. Some people grab those, the BT300. Yep. Now that a lot of those displays are officially not being made anymore, if you had a plasma, especially one that was in good shape or relatively new, you're in a safe spot where you could at least hold on for a little while. But for people that had some of those older PF series plasmas and hadn't taken advantage of some of the consumer monitors, I see a lot of post houses with, the classic, gray Panasonic Pro plasmas, and all of a sudden they're, wildly looking around for options. And then they're like, oh yeah, let's get a VT60. And then the ones that are left are on various places like Amazon for $1,000 or $2,000 more than their original list price, specifically because, and this is a phenomenon that's going away, but this happened where people were looking for something to jump to and there was no obvious option, something that everyone would officially agree is a good place to go. As a large screen replacement, and so finally now I think we got some new models that we'll talk about that are coming out that, good candidates.
Yeah, I think there was a period of time there where from the consumer side, if you're trying to cull from the consumer area for something for a client reference monitor, those VT or the GTs, that plasma series was kind of the go-to reference, professional consumer device, right? And there has been lacking that reference. I think a lot of people really like the Samsung LCD displays as kind of reference monitors. Some people are gravitating towards the Sony, the XBR displays as reference monitors, like those LCDs. But they never had the kind of ubiquitous acceptance that the VT series got, or the ZT towards the end there, as a kind of prosumer device, right?
I mean, for a minute they had the Pioneer that was kind of making its rounds as well early on.
But yeah, no, the Pioneer was the Kuro. That was always the thing, right? Well, every time Panasonic would make a new plasma, people would be like, is this Kuro worthy yet? Is this is this up there? Is this up to what the Pioneer was? And people would always say no. I remember when I bought my first plasma set for home, which was not that long ago, maybe 6 years, 7 years ago, the Kuro was like the kind of the chief competitor, but it was only available, like it only took a 1080i signal where the Panasonic took a 1080p, and so I went with the Panasonic just because I could do 1080p on it. But I still have that display at home.
Yeah. And it was always black levels. That was the thing that allowed a monitor to even be invited to the party. Like if it had decent black levels, then you could start exploring its grayscale balance and whether it had any issues. But with bad black levels, you just got...
And viewing angle.
Kicked out at the door. You know what? That's a great point actually too, is I think actually like a lot of the newer LCDs, the very, very new ones that have been released this year, even this summer, they have decent black levels, and we've officially gotten to a point where we'll accept them, sort of into consideration. But then a constant comment after that is the viewing angle is terrible. And the thing that's, I think, largely true is that on anything that's a large display, let's say over 30 inches, that's a high-performance color accurate display, is they all universally have some sort of viewing angle problem. Like that's the next major issue to overcome.
Yeah. The viewing angle is even on the Dolby reference monitor, which is you would say this is the highest performing LCD monitor available today, consumer or professional or anything else, right? The Dolby reference monitor is the zenith of LCD monitoring. And even on that device, you get out far enough off the axis, and you can see the kind of the haloing effect quite pronounced. You can see small kind of black level shifts. If you're used to plasma or you're used to CRT, it's very distracting.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's funny is that, what people have to remember is that a lot of times, people are spending what they think is a lot of money, but largely in the grand scheme of things, it's sort of what we'll call, good but lower echelon gear. So if you have a $4,000 or $5,000 budget for a display, and maybe people even spend less than that, that's a very decent amount of money. But when you're looking at the opportunity to spend $40,000 or $50,000 and you still have problems, you kind of have to keep it in perspective as to what you can get for $5,000. So there's a lot of people, there's a lot of very picky people out in, color accuracy land. And the thing is that you can burn big Formula One style money to still have imperfection. So
yeah, you still have caveats like don't do this with it because it'll do that. I mean, but and the plasmas have the same caveats. I mean, not the same caveats, but they have caveats as well. Like the ABL can make it difficult to calibrate. The displays are inherently generally less stable and require more recalibration. They'll shift over time. The overall brightness will kind of come down over the life of the display. They just don't get as bright eventually. And I think that brings us to sort of what I feel like, and I feel really bullish on, I think bullish is the right term. I'm near Wall Street, but not on Wall Street, but I'm very positive on the idea of OLED. I think OLED to me is very much becoming the future, both from a professional perspective and also from the consumer side. We see those new consumer LG OLED sets that, at least from the reviews, have looked like they can be quite solidly calibrated. And if you've seen them in person, they look amazing. They're phenomenal. I mean, they're everything that's great about OLED, which is, phenomenal blacks, amazingly stable gamma response, really great colorimetry, very, very, a nice, like it's a pleasant viewing experience to me. That incredibly high contrast ratio, just to my eye, just looks pleasing and inviting, and it makes my mouth water if the right image comes on it. You know, and it's something that we've been looking at in the professional side with the OLED since the last podcast, where I think we were talking about the first generation Sony OLED panels. And in that time, we've had the second generation Sony OLED panels, which have even better wide viewing angles and don't have the off-axis issues, or as much of them, and are looking phenomenal and are being used very, very widely. And now you've had OLED professional OLEDs come out from third-party manufacturers. Like you've got the CM250 from FSI, which is really incredibly reasonably priced at, like, I think it's $6,500 right now, and they've always got kind of specials and stuff, so you sometimes can get it for even less. And those are fantastic displays with, I mean, amazing sort of input capabilities. You can do 2K HDSDI, and it'll do XYZ, and it'll do 12-bit, and it'll do, I mean, these things that really prior to this monitor only really belonged in like the very, 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 very high end, where you're talking about $30,000 displays. It's available in a $6,500 display. Right. That's kind of insane.
Yeah, I mean, since we did the last podcast, I moved from an LCD to an OLED as well. So I'm using the PVM2541B.
A.
Is it A? I always forget that. Yeah, the second rev of it.
Is it the A? There's an A2541... Or a 2541A or an A250, which is the thinner one. Is it thinner or thicker?
No, it's the thicker one.
The thicker one. So it's the 2541A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's great. And, I mean, comparing that with a, we were using like a JVC LCD, which was fine. I mean, it worked. It was, you know, accurate and all of that, but it definitely did not have the same contrast ratio as you have on a OLED. The thing about it that's a little tricky, though, is it's so contrasty compared to what maybe, because I mostly do broadcast TV, is it's more contrasty than what somebody might have at home. So I always kind of try to keep that into consideration when I'm grading on the OLED as well. But as you say, if the OLEDs do take off, then that just means everybody's going to have that same level of contrast, which is great.
Well, we do have to kind of keep an eye on that, right? So my approach is to sort of take the blacks up a tick on the OLED, so they're not quite that, you know, immeasurably deep black
right.
that they have, which is, I mean, if you've ever like calibrated or measured an OLED and you put up a black signal on that screen, and maybe you're in a black environment, like to some degree, the screen feels darker than the space around it. It's unbelievably dark and just pitch black, which is incredible. But it can maybe be a bit intimidating from a colorist perspective, because you're always kind of wondering like how accurate or reliable is that relative to what people are going to see at home?
Yeah, as they would say in Spinal Tap, how much more black can it be?
We start going into like negative light. You start like light absorbing diodes. I think it's a pretty smart idea to sort of take it and raise it a little bit on the set, so you're not quite at that black level. You have some perceptible difference between on or off states on the monitor, even if it's just a slight little bit. I think Steve Shaw has been recommending 0.005 or 0.05 lumens as kind of black level. I don't know if I would go that bright. I think that's more like an LCD performance level. I would go a little bit dimmer than that, but I don't disagree with the idea of just artificially taking up the black a little bit. And that's the great thing about those displays, is you don't have to go as dark as they go. They can go. You can go as dark as you feel like you're comfortable going.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting is that at least you have control of it. You know, so one day when it comes exactly. to the point where the consumer world catches up, you can go to that very dark black. But for right now, you can lift it a little.
Yeah, and that's why we don't just use the monitor, we use the scopes as well, so we can keep an eye on if we're crushing the blacks or where they're at, so it's kind of, you're getting the whole picture of it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also, I mean, there's just, it can kind of bite you the other way, too. I mean, if you're kind of, if you're overly lifted, you'll tend to push the blacks down maybe to a denser point than you would otherwise. I think that that's always the hazard with like LCD screens is, you know, when you have like really high blacks and you're sort of like, you're trying to get some density in an image, you may over push the image to compensate for the lighter screen. So it goes both ways. And, you know, that's always an issue. You have to, you know, it was a lot easier back in the days when everybody was on CRTs at home and at work. So we all had pretty much the same gamma response and the same kind of black level response on our sets. Now we're not. And so we, but it's also really difficult to account for every single permutation of consumer devices because they vary quite a bit. I mean, some of the cheaper LCD panels that are still being sold today are, you know, LN or TN type panels that don't get very good black levels and frankly, you know, are very, very low contrast, you know. And so it's that's a pretty bad reference to be kind of grading against as well.
Yeah.
In terms of the last 2 years, how have your monitor setups changed since we last covered this? So Josh, you got an OLED from an LCD, and then Juan, are you still using the same OLED set that you were using a while back?
We've gotten the newer ones. So we're on the A panels, we have BVMs and PVMs that we're using. But then in my, you know, I guess since we last covered this, we added projection. So, I got a DI theater together. So that has now become kind of, I guess, my primary display if I had to pick one. And that's a whole different, you know, experience as well. So, you know, what I'm doing from time to time is, you know, I'll work in kind of my DI room. And if I have clients or if I'm doing something for theatrical, obviously I'll do it on the projector. But if I'm unsupervised or I'm working for the web or for a broadcast unsupervised, I will use the OLED. So I'll bring the OLED in, kind of wheel it in and put it in front of my station and work off that. Just because it's more energy efficient and it feels more intimate and close to me. I don't have to kind of put on my glasses and see the image. And then I usually will end up doing a pass on the projector anyways, but that's the setup in the main theater. And then we have the room upstairs, which is still BT300 and OLED. And those are calibrated to sort of match. We're using the kind of the Judd offset for the OLED. So it's the white point's a little bit offset. So it holds up really, really well with the plasma. And they have similar, though not the same, but similar kind of contrast and black point and so the images feel really similar on those two displays.
So if you were going to replace your, let's say, BT300, what are your big candidates if you were going to try to move forward right now?
The thing that gets me excited and that I will be keeping an eye on is that LG 9300?
Yeah.
The consumer OLED,
right.
Which is curved, which is a drawback, but it's a white OLED, which is a slightly different OLED tech than the RGB OLED that you get in the Sonys and the FSIs. But having seen it, it just looks gorgeous, and the tests show that it's pretty solid. I can't help but think that that's kind of the go-to, or will become the go-to kind of client reference monitor in the near future. And then LG also has a UHD 65-inch set that's coming out, or should be out by now, although it might be delayed, which I think is like $10,000, which is really, really exciting as a reference monitor because it's UHD but it's also OLED. And so I find that one pretty compelling as well.
Yeah, don't you think that a lot of those big client monitors are going to have to get replaced with something that does UHD if we start delivering in that format?
Sure, and you're seeing broadcast kind of going that way maybe faster than we anticipated, you know, where they're adding UHD deliveries to TV series at maybe a faster clip than you would have thought, you know, a year or two ago. I think mostly because of the streaming stuff, right? Like the Amazons and the Netflix and those guys are kind of going, can have the ability to go UHD without having a broadcast spec in place, because they can kind of determine their own broadcast spec and you know, just work with devices. So that's a real issue, because we don't really have a great reference display for UHD right now. You know, the best UHD displays or 4K displays are really projectors. And I think by and large, the 4K projectors, even today, are underperforming the equivalent 2K projector. Like, the contrast ratio isn't as good. The black level isn't as good. So you're sacrificing some level of image quality in order to get that resolution on the projection. Flat panel displays, it's when they first came out, particularly maybe a year ago, the UHD displays were kind of a step backwards in terms of viewing angle and black levels versus what we had for HD displays.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and one of the things too, and you know, it's sort of something that's creeping in, but I'll tell you, you know, around the people that I see looking for new displays, it's actually three things they want. They need the color accuracy on a large display. They need UHD, and they also want HDR. And that's a really tough request right now. And HDR is still something that is being figured out. You know, there's a lot of companies that are sort of exploring it, and it's not as settled in terms of the future as UHD. But one of the things that we found is that a couple of displays are finally offering a certain amount of HDR. And HDR is kind of interesting. When you have to do the tremendous amount of light output that's sometimes required, the display can't offer those light levels across the entire display. So what you find is that you'll get an HDR rating that's based on, say, a given nit level across a certain percentage of the display. So one display that's come up a lot recently for me is the X950B, which is a Sony UHD display that's also quite color accurate and also is able to do 1,000 nits across 5% of the screen at any given moment. And so a lot mm-hmm. of people are looking at that as a not a perfect monitor, but something that they feel like they could at least purchase now that would handle whatever might come up until it's all decided what's important, you know. So
you still, like, for that monitor, it is still an LCD monitor.
It is, but it's a good LCD monitor in that it has very nice black levels. Like, for instance, you know, Steve Shaw was describing, and I hadn't heard this before you, Juan, but if Steve Shaw was describing a 0.05 black level, just for reference, the HP Dreamcolor, the new Dreamcolor does 0.046. So that's interesting, you know, that, sure. that coincidentally those are pretty close. I think the XB950 does a bit better than that. You know, so as far as, you know, OLED level blacks, no, it does not do that. But color accurate, nice black levels, like officially nice, not compromised, but very good looking. And then also this ability to do UHD and HDR to a certain extent, not at the extent of some monitors, like, you know, we were looking at those SIM displays, right, guys? I put that picture mm-hmm. up on Lift Gamma Gain. And if you take a look at an actual, what we'll call a full panel, you know, what I think the SIM does something like 4,000 or 5,000 nits, you know, the entire back of the display is heat sinks and fans, you know, sure. It looks like something that, you know, you'd use as a light weapon on a battlefield or something, you know, you'd like aim it at your enemy and blind them, you know, and actually there's
and if you've seen HDR out of hand, it is kind of a light weapon. It does actually physically hurt your eyes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And these companies are actually saying, look, you need to be careful when you do your test because
absolutely.
There is a real possibility of damage if you don't watch it.
Well, this is one of the things that's kind of, to me, is a little, I think, a wrench in the works when it comes to HDR, which is also a wrench in the works when it comes to 3D, which is if 3D is done badly, you can give someone an instant headache. Like, I can, if I have a 3D image up, I can twist a couple of knobs and give you a headache on command. Like, because I've done it to myself inadvertently, and it's pretty awful. Like, when that happens, it's not a pleasant experience. And I think the HDR done wrong can give somebody, you know, a pretty painful experience. You know, it's a little scary when you start developing tech that can actually cause pain to people. It's a little bit
we used to only be able to do that with the story
with the story.
But now we could do with the color too.
Then we can make them cry with an image.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, you know, the scenes with walking into the light will take on a new level of, you know, this isn't necessarily heaven right now. I wish the scene would get over with.
it might be getting the dark place.
Yeah. How doable is it that we can actually see these monitors at that brightness level purely from a power consideration, because if you have to draw that much power, I mean, there's all kinds of regulations that we have on monitors as well.
That's why, like, the XBR, for example, will only do like 5% of the image at that level of brightness, right? So once you start going beyond a certain level of brightness, for absolute brightness for the image, you start to kind of have like an ABL function sort of kick in. So if you start, if you're raising the whole image up to 1,000 nits, the effective output will be like 100 nits. It's not going to be 1,000 nits. But if you're just raising up a small portion of the image, you'll be able to raise it up to 1,000 nits or whatever the display is rated for. So that keeps power consumption in check, but it also means calibration is going to be a little bit of a pain in the ass too, because it's basically an ABL that's built into the circuitry.
You know what else would be a really good one is if there's anybody that isn't familiar with what a nit is, and since you're, you know, sort of our walking, you know, technical liaison, tell people like what a common display output wise would be, and that what 1,000 is, and like what those SIM displays would do in the grand scheme of things.
Oh, sure. So, well, we measure light is measured linearly, which is, works a little bit differently than what you expect. So the numbers get a little funky. So basically, every doubling of the amount of light is a stop, a visual stop, right? So it's not double as bright. It's just an incremental increase in brightness. What you would see if you raise the aperture on a camera one stop, that level of brightness increase is actually double the amount of light hitting the sensor. And same thing applies for displays. So a normal NTSC or 709 reference for a display is around 100 to 120 nits, or candelas, which is whatever candelas, a meter
squared. CDM squared.
Mm-hmm. Those two terms are basically interchangeable. They're meant to define slightly different things, but the measurements are essentially the same. So when you hear somebody refer to nits, you can interchange that with candelas. And then there's foot lamperts, which is different, and that usually applies more towards projection. But we can convert those two numbers as well. So there is some correspondence there. So, for example, projection reference with film in the gate is 14 foot lamperts, which is 48 candelas or nits. So that's actually significantly dimmer than your kind of video level, which is 100 nits. So that's almost twice as much light, which is only a stop brighter. It's not twice as bright. You know, 50 nits is half as much light, but it's not half as much brightness. But if you consider that, then, you know, 200 nits is another stop from 100 nits, and then 400 nits would be a stop up from that, and then 800 nits would be another stop. So we're talking about three stops higher level of brightness at 800 nits. Obviously, 1,000 nits would fall somewhere in between that and the next stop. And the Dolby reference for HDR, I think the one that's shipping is a 2,000 nit monitor, and they've sort of developed or talked about a 4,000 nit monitor as being kind of the standard for professional reference. So that's 40-fold amount of light being emitted from the display than what is traditionally outputted from a NTSC display. In reality, while we say 100 nits is reference for broadcast displays, most of the consumer displays that you see in stores, when they're in kind of that vivid mode or the bright mode, they're outputting around 300 to 400 nits. So it's usually significantly brighter than what the reference is. So that, you know, that gives you an idea of kind of the normal level of performance from a display you would expect to see from a new display, not an HDR display, 300 to 400 nits of light output.
Yeah. And then in the end, you know, do you guys, like, I've seen a lot of chat about HDR almost as much as I've seen as far as 4K. Do you guys, UHD, have you guys had any, you know, I'm trying to be good. It's so easy to say 4K, but all of us need to stop that right away. Just for what it's worth. So UHD, I've seen a lot of...
Or just when we say 4K, we should mean 4K.
Yeah,
when we say
exactly.
UHD. I mean, those two words have meaning.
They do, and they're different. Should, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Are you guys hearing about HDR much? And I guess what I mean by that is, people who you talk with at a professional level considering it as something they want to sort of be prepared for, as opposed to just news releases from Variety or wherever?
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's a lot of information out there just yet. I think it's still pretty early in its development, right? I mean, it's out there, but it's not something that, you know, your friend who is not in post-production would actually know about. But UHD, you would see in a display in a store somewhere, and somebody would say, should I be buying that?
Well, Josh, I mean, in your segment of the industry, in like reality series, like producers, directors, shooters, is that in their brain space? Are they thinking about that as a possibility? Are they thinking about UHD as a possibility? What are they thinking about?
I mean, for the reality genre and stuff like that, it is probably not doable in terms of the amount of dailies that we generate to shoot UHD, mainly because of storage concerns, because it would just be massive. I mean, we're talking 1,500 to 2,000 dailies per season. So that's a lot of data.
Well, you guys have you've done stuff with XAVC before, right?
Yeah, we have. We shot a show that was all F55.
Right, and you shot that in HD XAVC?
Yes,
or 4K?
HD.
And did you think about going 4K with that?
I don't think that there was really, because the delivery was still HD, and what could have been good is if we needed to shoot some of the B-roll potentially in 4K, just mainly for reframing shots. I mean, that would be great. And, you know, even for certain wide shots, in reality, it might have made sense to shoot 4K. Right. But,
or like the interview testimonials, you'd be able to do wide
right,
and push.
Exactly. So it would look more like a two-camera shoot at that point. But we are constantly having problems with focus, even at HD levels. I can't even imagine what it's going to be like at 4K. So,
Uh-oh, Josh, you got to up. UHD.
Yes. Well, no, the F55 could shoot 4K, so you could be shooting in 4K.
That's what I meant, Jason.
I take it back until the next time. But one thing I was going to say, Juan, you have a lot of experience with Sony. There's a thing I've seen mentioned a lot. So XAVC, that's X265 based?
264.
265, right?
Four.
Oh, okay. So I thought it was going to be, I thought XAVC kind of like was an early implementation of 265.
No, it's a very advanced implementation of 264.
Okay, interesting. So there's a thought, though, that 265 will allow people to have a 4K image, but within a similar bandwidth of 264. Have you heard anything about that? I haven't chased that down. But
I think only for delivery. I don't think it's really an acquisition format as far as I've heard.
I mean, you're seeing acquisition pop up in 265. Like there's that new Samsung DSLR is recording H.265.
Right.
And
yes.
I think there's another camera that's recording H.265, which is really cool. But it's the same. I think you're going to run into, from an acquisition perspective, the same issues we run into with H.264 encoders in kind of consumer or prosumer devices today, which is that it's really lossy. You know, I think it's maybe a little bit unfair to compare XAVC to H.264, even though it is sort of an H.264 variant. It's not like a consumer-type H.264 encoder, which is losing a lot of information in order to maintain a certain bit depth or bit rate. The XAVC encoder is, you know, is a very high bit rate, and in fact has variants that go up to like 10, 12-bit images. You know, it's meant as a professional sort of working format. It wouldn't be a very good distribution format.
So when Netflix, say, distributes their 4K stream of House of Cards, is that still H.264? Do we know? Or is that H.265?
That's a really good question. And Netflix has, this touches on the idea of, you know, that the streaming services are really kind of creating the demand for UHD content, right? Because they're able to define their own specs because they're closed systems. You know, all they have to do is basically be able to play back on the devices that they need to play back on, computers and tablets and those set-top boxes, right? But like the Amazons and the Netflix and the Hulus and the HBO Goes of the world, can kind of set their own specifications outside of what's needed to play back.
They also have the advantage of the internet as an infrastructure, which is really flexible, and they can buffer. So if you have like regular broadcast TV, those sorts of things are very fixed, as opposed to the flexibility that the internet would provide.
Unless you're on Time Warner Cable.
Well, no, even then, I mean, it's a massive infrastructure they have to support, right? And it's from their perspective, it's like they have to, if they want to switch to H.265, they have to change the front end from their encoder side, and then they might have a pretty generic pipe that they could push that data through, but then they also have to change the front end on the consumer side. So it's a significant, like if they wanted to switch to H.265 tomorrow, they wouldn't be able to do it. It's a multi-billion-dollar probably proposition to make that change.
Yeah, and they need the hardware to support that too, because it requires more CPU
exactly.
power of the device.
Somebody has to make, and those chips are coming out now. I mean, there's H.265 encoder chips, obviously, and decoder chips, so those chips are coming out, but it's a significant lead time. So for them, it makes a lot more sense to wait until there's like a SMPTE specification that's going to apply to broadcast as well that they can conform to. And so then they have some level of future-proofing right. that they're investing in the right thing. But like, I mean, this was kind of one of the advantages for like the DirecTVs of the world, was that they had more flexibility because they just had a single satellite or a series of satellites that they could update and then get that out to a bunch of consumers at once. You know?
Like that seems to be a selling point of the TVs as well, is that they have more processors in them that they can, you know, that
yeah.
they can,
and they're flexible,
and flexible that way.
Stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's not quite so sexy to sell a TV, but,
well, that's been a technology shift, right? We used to have very kind of rigid, chips that were really performing a specific task, and had to be, you know, purpose-built for that task. And now we have these kind of more robust, more broadly purposable chips on these devices that can be reprogrammed. So you can have a chip that is doing H.264 today that could do H.265 tomorrow.
Right, or you just get another $100 Apple TV that can do
yeah.
the same thing.
Exactly.
Like, when is that going to come out? I wondered with my 720p
well,
Apple
when,
TV.
When is the iTV going to come out? The display device from Apple. And you know, because there were always rumors about them kind of wanting to do OLED and OLED for consumer sizes. And you know, we're talking about OLED now finally becoming a reality. But I've been aware of OLED and thinking about OLED and dreaming about OLED for 10 years, 15 years. And every time, you know, we'd kind of talk about it, it would be like, oh, they're just on the cusp of making very affordable, printable OLEDs that are going to get really big, really fast, and really cheap. But it never actually really happened. They would always kind of have issues with the yields or have issues with the manufacturing. And even now, you know, it's not. It seems like it's getting better because obviously we're getting bigger display devices, but it still kind of seems like it's painstaking. It's sort of like, okay, well, we went from a $10,000 50-inch OLED display to now a $3,500 50-inch OLED display, and that's a huge improvement. But it would be great to see a $1,200, you know, 42-inch OLED display. I would love to see that for consumers.
Yeah.
One question I have is, Sony moved out of the consumer OLED space. That's right. It's a true statement, correct?
The consumer part being the
consumer televisions, they are not
very very important part of that, because I think what Sony had was they had a ongoing development deal with Panasonic for devices for the consumer space, and they let that lapse. And now they've invested in another group that was doing some research in OLED. So there may still be something in the works. But they've had shipping professional OLEDs for a long time, and they were the first to market with a consumer device, and they're still using OLED panels in their phones and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not, they're not out of the OLED game, and consumer factoid had a big splash in the professional market, where people heard basically what the people read was the headline that Sony's getting out of OLED, but that hasn't really applied to the professional space. It was just saying something about a consumer space device that they never actually released. They had a small 11-inch consumer OLED device, and that was kind of the precursor to the professional OLED devices, but that's the only consumer OLED display device they've released outside of the phone.
Yeah. As I was wondering how LG was able to stand on its own if Sony was not participating, and it seems like there's another consortium. Is there a thing between Samsung and LG so that they can just move on their way and continue with it as they please, or are they relying on Sony in any way for manufacturing technology?
Well, there's nothing between Samsung and LG other than bad blood. You know, those two are not collaborating on anything as far as I know.
Okay.
But the technology that LG has that's OLED technology, you know, it's OLED in a broad sense of the word, right? So in that it's an organic light emitting diode, right? That's what OLED stands for. But the subsets of those technologies and the variances of those technologies can be very, very different between different devices. There's AMOLED, there's WOLED, there's RGB OLED, which Sony's using. There's different substrates for it. They're manufactured in different ways. They have different types of light emitting diodes, where the LG OLED has a white diode. The Sony's have different sized R and G and B diodes.
Wasn't there a company out there that they were selling a consumer TV and they were claiming that it was an LED TV, but they were just referring to the LED backlight of the TV?
They're all doing that, yeah. And consumers do that a lot.
Which, I mean, it's an LCD TV, but it actually, they're calling it an LED, disingenuous.
Correct.
And that was really common, well, too, yeah, that whole concept.
It's I mean, you look in adverts for televisions now, and any kind of LED backlit TV is referred to as an LED TV. It's really common, and it's kind of misleading, because it's not indicative of the display technology. The display technology is still an LCD technology. It's indicating the backlight technology. And then there's differences in that kind of technology too, right? You can have white LED, you can have blue LED with filtering, you can have red-green LED, you can have red-green-blue LED, you can have matrixed LED, you can have side-lit LED. There's 8 or 9 different variants in just the LED backlighting technology, and there's a bunch of different variants in the OLED technology.
And also the shuttering, too, with, like, you know, TN and TFT and, you know, the way that they actually, you know, modulate the light output.
Sure, yeah. And they'll IPS.
Right, and HIPS and APHIPS and blah, 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 blah.
Any other acronyms we didn't get in there? TPS?
Well, we got ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox. Yeah, yeah. So we got OLED, LCD, LED. Yeah.
Broadcast is second only to the Navy in acronym use.
Again, the TPS report.
But so, yeah, so the thought is that LG has their own deep investment in OLED, and they could very much, like with this Sony lapse, if you want to call it, you know, sort of create a nice ecosystem of their own without need for anyone else, it sounds like.
I would say there is a market that is waiting to be tapped in terms of large sized LED displays that are have decent yields and byproduct of having a decent yield have a reasonable pricing. That is, I think an OLED will continue to be a premium display for some time to come, but meaning the same way that the plasmas were a premium display over LCDs, I think the OLEDs will be a premium display over LCDs for a while to come. But I think that there's a good selling point for consumers if they're looking at devices. If you're trying to buy a device and you're wondering whether you get an LCD or an OLED, I think the OLED is going to win that contest if it's reasonably priced relative to the LCD. My opinion is the OLED is way better than the LCD, right? So I would definitely, even if it's double or triple the price, I would go for OLED. But if it's, you know, if it's a 25 or 30 or 40% premium, I think you're going to see a lot of consumers make that same choice.
Yeah, because, I mean, looking at them side by side, you're going to see the difference, I think.
Oh, yeah. In the showroom, I mean, those blacks, you know, are undeniable, right? Like, you know, in a dimly lit showroom, you're going to be able to see that night and day difference in terms of contrast between those two.
Yeah,
devices.
And then people won't necessarily say, oh, it's better contrast. They'll say that one looks sharper than that one, or that one seems
more detailed or more vivid. Right. There's also something to say for the possible gamut of those devices, right? RGB OLED can get very, very, very wide gamut, wider than most LCD devices.
So I guess in terms of some of these, you know, gamut related questions, for instance, like, you know, 2020 and 1886, you know, seems like 1886 is very decently in place. You know, will something like OLED allow everybody to start moving toward a 2020 on a daily basis, in five years or something?
I have a question for the experts here. Can you do Rec 2020 with an LCD? I assume you can because the Dolby monitor should be able to, right?
So let's say this. Rec 2020, if you look at the gamut in Rec 2020, it's unbelievably wide. And there really aren't any display devices today outside of like experimental laser technology that can really hit that wide of a gamut. We're talking about a gamut that's almost outside of visible light. So I think the Rec 2020 spec is more aspirational than a literal spec that the set is intended to hit. But what's going to be important about it, and part of what the whole Dolby Vision, although I guess they're not calling it that anymore, part of that whole portion of the proposal to the spec is that it would require set manufacturers to basically rate their own displays according to the display's performance, and then, you know, adjust the signal so that it would fit within the display's performance. So that said, I think OLEDs are going to be kind of the closest outside of lasers to that sort of full Rec 2020 experience.
So what was the mission statement when 2020 came about? You know, because it seems like, you know, SMPTE and maybe the EBU and these various organizations, you know, almost seem to come up with a spec after a need has been sort of screamed for a long time. But this one is way ahead of itself. So what was the cause for 2020? Do you have any idea?
We never want to use a legalizer ever again.
That's kind of true. I mean, I guess you wouldn't have to use a legalizer. That's a good point. I think they were sort of thinking of, let's get a step ahead of things, right? Because the technology has been changing so quickly and evolving so fast, and I think they've always sort of been a step behind. And they were like, well, if we start planning for something that's six steps ahead of where we are, by the time we get it implemented, we might be a step or two ahead, and that'll be pretty good. That'll be better than we've been doing. So I think maybe that was kind of the thinking behind it.
Yeah. I mean, is there a thought that does Rec 2020 have any kind of timeline associated with it when we'd hope to be there? Or?
No, but if you look at the spec, it goes even beyond what you would think we would initially implement, right? So there's a spec for UHD. For the sake of nomenclature, let's say a 4K-ish image. But then there's a spec for the 8K-ish image, which is FUHD. So it goes way beyond. And then there's specs for like, part of the spec is for like high frame rate stuff. And now we're talking about HDR within the spec. So, I mean, we're really talking about technology that's way ahead of where we are in any capacity today, where we hope to be in some years down the line.
So what I want to know, Juan, is did you just say FUHD?
That's what it's called, yeah, FUHD.
I want to see the ads for that.
Yeah, F your wallet, because that's what's going to happen. Wow, okay, so full ultra HD? Is that what they're...
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
8 implies fullness, okay. Right. It's going to be interesting to see it when it's, you know, minimum 110 inches across. You know,
fullness of storage.
Or you have your tablet with a FUHD display.
Fullness of image and emptiness of wallet. That's what
right.
it means.
Although with the way things are going now, it's like, you know, you have there's like those little tablet devices from, who has it that has like a 4K tablet device?
Oh, Panasonic.
Was it Panasonic?
Yeah.
I mean, it's craziness. It's not like...
And it's really big. It's like 24 inches across.
Yeah, but they're not even the only ones. I mean, there's some like 2800 pixel like tablet devices. Like there's an Asus tablet that's like 2800 by something or other. I mean, like the pixel density is getting kind of a bit insane.
Yeah. One thing that I'm interested in is that, you know, we've got a lot of people who are probably trying to, you know, solve their color accuracy issues on a budget. And we've had some fun discussions about this.
Yes.
And I was wondering if we could broach that. I think it's a practical
the dream
matter too for
the,
a lot of people trying to get their first, you know, color accurate displays. Juan, you ended up getting an Azo CX, what was it, the 271 like I did, right?
For the flame,
yeah. And so yeah. I know that there are some other displays out there that are really hot, like the HP, what is it, the Z27X, and some of these other displays. So, you know, one of the big taboos is the idea that these are traditionally computer monitors. So what are you guys, you know, thinking in terms of some of these more affordable options?
I really like my NEC PA monitor. I don't grade on that, but one thing that I really like about it is the fact that it's got a closed loop calibration option. So they sell their own specific probe made for that monitor, like they do for the Dreamcolor. And
yeah, it's probably an OEM I1.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And you plug it in and it does its thing, and then it says it's calibrated. Now the guy who I use to do my calibrations would probably say, well, there's a lot more, you know, that you want to fix and do manually to truly have something calibrated. But for, you know, really for, it takes about 3 minutes. You plug it in and you do it every 2 or 3 weeks. It looks pretty close to me.
Yeah, I mean, what it's probably doing is something that, like, Steve Shaw would, like, scoff at, which is, it's probably doing a 1D, like a 10 point, you know, grayscale, and then a colorimetry, you know, just red, green, blue at 75 or 100 patches. And that's, you know, that'll get close enough to where you can kind of not feel weird seeing your image up on your computer display, which is a really good thing, I think, generally when you're, you know, particularly if you're working with clients in the room or something and they're looking at the computer display and it looks completely different from your broadcast display, that can be a little disconcerting. And I think having a computer display that can approach that level of accuracy is really handy, right? Yeah, it's helpful. I mean, I use in my DI room, we have Dell GUI monitors, and also we have like the HPs in the room upstairs, not the Dreamcolor, but the Z displays, which are also pretty good. And the Ezio in the flame room, which is, I mean, that's more about just kind of staying in spec with what Autodesk expects, but you know, it holds up really nicely. It's nice having a monitor that doesn't make you second guess everything you've done in the color room, you know. So that's a handy feature. And those displays are really reasonably priced. You know, they're not crazy. You know, they probably range from some of the displays we're talking about are probably in the $700 range, and they go up to, you know, what's the CX is what, $1,600
Yeah, and then it's big brother, the CG277 is around $2,200.
Right, and they're really well made, like well built displays. They're really nice. The Dream Colors maybe feel a little more plasticky in their build. You know, it's like splitting hairs, you know, trying to find differentiation between those displays in the application that they're intended for, which is not critical color, but maybe critical image work, like, you know, visual effects work, editorial work, CG. That's those sort of applications, which is what those monitors are more or less designed for. They work really, really, really well for that purpose.
I guess the thing that's the question that, you know, that I was exploring, because actually that's what I've been doing recently, is using the CX271 in a sort of a semi-long-term way to see how the results of some of the projects I'm doing, which are not big deal releases in any way. They're just things that I'm doing that might have some sort of, you know, theatrical showing at a film festival or something like that, just to try the concept out in order to sort of scrape the bottom and see what the end result was at a very practical level. And I think, I think one of the things is that as long as you are very strict about the monitor's abilities, for instance, this idea that you only could really view progressive material, you can't look at anything interlaced, you have to understand the fact that this is a repurposed computer display. I think the thing that I am hopeful for is the idea that some of these displays, like especially the CX271 and you know, some of the others, would allow people who had no shot at any kind of color accuracy that those people would actually be able to experience that for the first time. Because the challenge is that color critical displays have always been very expensive. And is there a way mm-hmm. to get them at least closer? They will have at least had some initial experience, and then they can move on when they're finally getting, let's say, paid to something that a person getting paid would buy, which is, you know, a $5,000 FSI or Sony.
I mean, that's a really complicated question to answer too, because, you know, you have the issue of the kind of the lost money that you're putting into a display, or essentially lost money that could have otherwise been applied to a real broadcast display, right? Because, I mean, we're talking about something in the neighborhood of a $1,100 to $1,500, $1,600 for one of these devices in a color use, right? But that's not that far off from what the FSI would be. Like a FSI CM171 is, I think, $2,400 or $2,500.
The one thing is, though, is that, like, you know, that's almost, let's say, a reasonable doubling of your money. I mean, if every one of us could go to any project and just double our budget, we'd all be way happier. And that's the one thing I think is that it depends on who you are, you know. And again, we're speaking about people who probably aren't getting paid yet, but who want to have some sort of rigor, an initial entry point.
But that's the thing, is if you're somebody who's not getting paid yet, but you want to have some sort of rigor, is it the best use of your, let's say you have $1,200, right? Is it better to use up that $1,200 on something that doesn't provide any longevity, or to make do with what you have, maybe buy a probe and calibrate, do like a, you know, X-ray probe calibration on your desktop or on your existing display. And then, so you're spending $250, let's say, instead of spending $1,200, and then take that money and apply it towards down the line purchase of something that's going to be quite a bit more useful and have more longevity and use over time than the device that you would, you know. Is it's like the old lease or buy a car question, right? Is it better to kind of get something that you can afford now, or to hold on to for something that's going to fill your needs better down the line? You know, I'm not making a claim to have a definitive answer, but it's not such a straightforward.
Yeah, the question comes up a lot, and I mean, the one thing that we can all agree on, I'm sure, is the quality of the monitor will affect your level of color, in my experience. So if you do have a better monitor, I think that you will color better. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
And I don't think it makes sense to spend on, I mean, you could, there's always an option, like, as far as if we're using the same metaphor of a car, is you could always sell that off too. I mean, you could start with something
right.
minor and then sell that back off with the probe and say, hey, somebody else is beginning. This is a good starter monitor to use, or something like that.
That's a good question, though, because I think in terms of just resale value, you're not going to get that much resale value out of a sort of mid-tier computer display as you would out of a low-end baseband video display.
Well, I mean, so, first off, if you look at the Azos, they're not mid-tier.
Yeah, I mean, well,
that's about
we're
as good
about
as
the Azos.
Yeah,
right. We're talking about the Azos, but you know, a lot of people making this kind of distinction are comparing Dell's, Asus, NECs, HPs. Maybe they're thinking about the Azos as kind of a high end of that. But you know, we're talking the Azos. You're talking about $1,400, $1,500 on the low end, and going up from there. So then you're not talking about such a big difference to the low end FSI.
Well,
you know?
First off, just for what it's worth, a couple things. I have a ZR24W, which is probably similar to the HPs you have in your bay, right? You said you
mm-hmm.
have ZRs,
yep.
right? And that's a beautiful display. I paid $500 for mine. When I first
yeah.
started learning smoke, that's the display I got. You know, smoke
sure.
on Mac. So anyway, it was an attempt to have a good display that was a good counterpart to smoke. I have some calibration gear, and you can't calibrate the ZR24W as a decent display to be,
yeah.
you know, remotely Rec 709. It's not capable of it. So the idea
yeah.
of buying a $250 probe, which I did, and to go and calibrate the quote unquote display that one might have, hoping that improves things, is sort of, to me, a situation that won't get a person like very far ahead.
That's a fair point, but let's say you're assuming that you want to calibrate to hit 100% of Rec.
I'm trying to get people into a decent Rec 709, you know, viewing environment that they can go and say, hey, when I put my project up on a TV, which is where a lot of their stuff will be viewed, they at least had something that was better than their $300 Samsung. You know,
but I think the thing that's going to get them there to where it's better than the $300 Samsung is having the white point correct, having good kind of RGB separation, having a solid grayscale response, that and having gamma properly set, that having that gets them perceptibly close.
So then you say, what's the lowest price point to have those things? And my thought would be that you can probably get those in one of these nicer, you know, computer displays with the caveats they can't do interlace things, and you're limited to say 24 or let's say 30p or whatever. You know,
I agree that it might be there, but in all likelihood, the person doing this calculation already has a display that they maybe can get close enough for their purpose. I mean, you're talking about somebody with no budget, where you know any expense is a hard expense, something that you know takes them real, you know, thought, and it's not something that they do lightly. If you're trying to kind of count your pennies, I would count my pennies by saving them towards something that gives you confidence. The ultimate thing to me here is, you know, what the display, the real purpose of the display is peace of mind, because that's the thing that as a colorist drives you nuts, right? If you can work on any display, but you have to have the confidence that display is showing you something that's accurate to what the specification is, to what the standard is, so that you can have that peace of mind. And I just, my concern is just, I don't know how much, there's so much else that needs to fit correctly in order to make one of those displays work as a device that gives you peace of mind that could go wrong, that if you don't have a corresponding device that does give you that peace of mind to which to compare it to, you kind of lost. I think the Ezios and the Dream Colors work great in an environment where they're not the final say on the image because you have a real display available. So in our flame room, you know, we can say that Ezio is holding up really nicely to what we did in the color room, so we have some confidence that it's accurate. Or it's holding up really nicely to the OLED that's right next to it, so we have some confidence that it's accurate. But if you don't have that device, then if it's off, you don't know it's off.
Well, how about this? This was some of the you know, sort of justification I put into it. And this has a lot to do with sort of the time I was working with Josh on broadcast TV things. So Josh, you know that JVC SDI reference monitor you used for a long time, right?
Uh-huh.
Those displays were being used for, you know, what we'll call very nice, you know, broadcast television. It's actually being polished and it goes out nicely. So those panels in those SDI reference monitors were, let's say, 2 or 3 years old, right? Because you guys just went through a recent upgrade cycle where you then bumped to OLEDs. What I would say is that if you can get a hold of one of these newer higher-end computer displays, the panel, at least, in those displays is going to be a lot more modern than something that was from like a 2010 or 2011 era SDI display. The big thing the SDI display is going to have is that wonderful SDI input. But with a little bit of effort, HDMI is supported in a lot of cases on video I/O devices. And I still think one of the big components of all this is calibration. And so there's a certain thought that, you know, one really needs to invest possibly into a color backend. And the thing that creates the longevity for me is if you can get that high quality panel and save money on some things initially, like let's say you go and you get, you know, one of the DeckLink or AGA cards that offers HDMI rather than say a full DeckLink, and you get the best panel that you can come up with. Then what happens is later on you can go and invest in like a LUT box or possibly something that would be what we'll call a full calibration solution. Instead of saying taking that initial $1,100 or $1,200 you have and putting it into say a used SDI monitor with a 3 or 4 year old panel in it. And so what I see is a lot of people looking at that as their introductory option. And I'm like, you know, you're buying really dated technology. Why don't you get something that's at least modern and then you can build off it with things like a LUT box and calibration later and really take it to the house.
I don't disagree with any of your points there, other than to say that I'm not sure that's the best use of the $1,200 in either case. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if it's if it's a tough spot. If you're in that spot where you're trying to find a $1,200 solution that's going to give you professional results, you're going to be in a bind no matter what, any way you look at it. You know, I would think if I found myself in that position, knowing what I know and having had the experience that I've had, I would probably just go and rent something and try to earn enough money to where I could buy eventually. Like I would rent for a day to do kind of my review pass and try to work with a computer monitor in the meantime that I had, and just work that way, you know, try and figure something out until I could earn a little bit and maybe buy the like a low end FSI, which I think is a really, really great value. It's not an easy position to be in. There's all kinds of different answers, but like I think you've said this before, Jason. You're talking about compromises, and it's a question of which compromises are you willing to make.
I think it also matters about like what their end goal is too, because a lot of people figure, well, I'm going to buy a monitor, and then I'll get clients, and then I'll start, you know, billing things. But it's not the traditional way that people were come up. I mean, put into a different circumstance, if somebody said, I learned the software, I became an assistant, I worked in a room that was fully calibrated and ready to go.
Exactly.
Then they start learning with the correct equipment without having to invest any money.
Yeah. And I mean, just this is kind of this problem is sort of a new world problem for our industry, right? It's because the software and some portion of the hardware has become so economical that this is now the situation that many people find themselves in, where they're trying to find equally economical options for every step of the chain. And some portions of the chain just don't have
that. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. And so the hard thing is like, I mean, your suggestion of this Ezio device and a HDMI interface and maybe a LUT box in between it, it's a really valid solution. The problem is that the accoutrement needed in order to really support it and have the confidence in it requires the investment in the other stuff too. You need a CMS, you need, you know, the proper probe, you need a monitor that you can just compare an image to and be like, yeah, that looks right, that looks the same, or no, it doesn't look right, something's fundamentally wrong here, let me recheck my levels of my signal and see what I did wrong. Because I mean, that's my big fear, is like, what if you just have wrong signal levels somewhere in your chain, and which is easy enough to do, and you calibrate with those wrong signal levels, and you never really know, because you're not looking at scopes externally, you're not looking at another device, you never know that your signals are so out of whack that your calibration's all wrong and your image is wrong.
Yeah, that's totally valid too. And what I'll say is that the minute anybody gets into calibration, the first thing they're going to realize is how much can go wrong. regardless of how, you know, we'll do a podcast on that alone. But you know what, here's the thing, and you guys have the same situation. I had a lot of people that ping me asking, you know, questions about stuff. And, you know, the thing that I didn't want to be this guy. Imagine, you know, you're somebody who's an expert at baseball, and you've trained a lot of good players that went on to have good careers in, say, college or pro. And a young baseball player comes up to you, he's like 12 or 13, and he's like, will you help me? And it's kind of like, if I suggest only $3,000 and $4,000 options to people monitorize, it's kind of like the idea of saying to the kid, okay, I'm only going to help you if you promise right now that you're going to go pro. And so I was trying to say, okay, if I really wanted to tackle a real world practical problem that has been coming up over and over and over again, how low can we go, so to speak, and still have a practically decent result with the idea that we send up gigantic banners saying, you know, asterisks, but you can't XYZ, you know what I mean? So, sure. So the thing is that, you know, I think more than anything is not an attempt at a definitive answer. I think it's a lot like, to me, the idea of trying to figure out what GTX or AMD consumer gaming card, you know, works really well and optimally, you know, for, you know, professional creative applications. And that's a world that sort of exploded and many people feel they have benefited from. But early on, you know, a lot of people were very strict about things, and then they learned that there was benefit there as long as you were careful about, you know, the caveats. And I think the displays are the same thing, just the cycle is a little bit later on, and it's sort of starting now, whereas the whole GTX in a Macintosh or, you know, instead of a Quadro and so on and so forth is well sort of figured out, so much that people are absolutely comfortable with it, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that's a great analogy, and it's sort of it's definitely a controversial point. You know, it's not so easy to say, give somebody a definitive answer to what is the right thing to do in that situation. It's a tricky situation. And it was last time we did this display show. And I think the solution that we came up with then was to say that the kind of the entry level FSI type solution is sort of very cost effective and reliable, but it's still an expense. You have ways to kind of, try to figure it out on your own that are cheaper. And the middle tier solutions now have become really, really robust. I mean, we've seen OLED take off in a big way, and we're still kind of stuck in a deeper spot. We're a little more stuck with those kind of larger client displays where we have maybe less options than we had before. So it's interesting to watch the sort of display side of things change quite a bit. I think we'll leave it at that, and we'll probably touch on this again maybe in another year or two when we're all debating whether OLED or some unknown technology is going to be the way to go, and I'll still be saying that computer displays aren't fit for for video critical applications, and we'll still be arguing about that, I'm sure. With that, I'm just going to wrap it up and say that I'm Juan Salvo. I'm a colorist in New York City. You can find me at thecolorspace.com. That's C-O-L-O-U-R space.
And I'm Josh Petok. You can talk to me on Twitter at Josh Petok, or check out my website at www.joshpetok.com.
And I'm Jason Myris. You can find me at jasonmyris.com and on Twitter at Jason Myris, and also on Lift Gamma Gain, where we'll be posting this podcast and having a discussion about displays and posting a lot of links to the model numbers and some of the articles we referred to in the episode. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.